I'll introduce them before each one speaks rather than after it. One, the former U.S. Ambassador to China, Sir Shukelty Roy, is currently Director of the Kissinger Institute on China in the United States at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars in Washington, D.C. I will not go through the very impressive, nearly full-page biography that is included in your packages, and I encourage you to read the full. I will simply say that one sentence that Stone writes is that Ambassador Roy participated in the secret negotiations that led to the establishment of USPRC diplomatic relations. And I think that is something very, very significant to be kept in our minds as we hear what Ambassador Roy has to say. Thank you very much for coming, and we look forward to hearing from you.
Good morning, and my thanks to the group of 78 for bringing me to Ottawa to enjoy this marvelous fall weather. The last time I was in Ottawa was in 1975, and it was the middle of winter, and walking outside was not nearly as pleasant. Let me pick up on some things from our speaker last night, who made a fantastic presentation. The world is indeed changing. The period of Atlantic dominance is ending, and in contrast to many earlier periods of world history, the instrument of change has been economic development, not military conflict. This is a very important point. If you look at the 25 largest economies in the world, as listed in the CIA World Factbook, which is available online, we find that the two largest economies, measured in terms of purchasing power parity, are still the European Union and the United States, each of which has an economy approximating $16 trillion in size. But the next three in size are Asian, and 21 of the top 25 countries come from Asia, the Middle East, Africa, and Latin America. Just for fun, I totaled up the GDPs of the 21 countries and found that they in total are $3 trillion larger than the combined GDP of the United States, the EU, Canada, and Russia. If you move Russia from the European group over to be with the BRICS, so you have 22 countries, then the differential is $8 trillion larger than those of the United States, EU, and Canada. If you bring Japan from the Asia group and put it in with the Western countries, you get rough parity. There's about a $1 trillion difference in the size then of the 21, the Asians plus Russia, and Japan linked with the European group. But this is a radically different situation from 30 years ago. Now, economic power doesn't automatically translate into political and military power. But it's the underpinning for national power. The impact of the global financial crisis of 2008, which we've heard about, which plunged the economies of the United States and Europe into deep recession, fostered the impression that the countries of the West are in decline. When you combine this with China's rapid recovery from the financial crisis in 2008, it's enhanced the impression that the countries of the West are in decline, while China is continuing its rapid rate of growth. Impressions matter, because an impression of the United States and the Western decline is fostering doubts among East Asian countries about the U.S. staying power in the region. This is not difficult to understand. If United States financial difficulties force the United States to reduce its regional military presence in East Asia as part of a global cutback, while China continues to rise, then doubts about the United States are going to significantly increase, and the worries of China's neighbors about the implication of China getting wealthier and stronger are going to become much more severe. So therefore, contrary to the way the United States administration is defining the rebalancing strategy, I think it is more accurate to think of it as an effort by the United States to demonstrate that the United States has both the will and the resources to remain actively engaged in East Asia as we regain our economic health. That's a different proposition. We already have the forces in East Asia that we need. When people talk about the percentage of our forces will be increased in East Asia, that's because they'll be decreasing elsewhere. When we talk about moving new forces in East Asia, that's so they can be stationed on the West Coast, which is cheaper than maintaining them far abroad. So I think the impression of the United States in talking about rebalancing is to try to make it look as though we're dealing from a position of strength. I think, in fact, it's quite the opposite. Now, the United States cannot revert back to the type of isolationism that marked the 1930s. More despite our diminished resources in the United States, should we be quick to jump to the conclusion that the United States is rapidly fading as a great power. Even hard-nosed Chinese analysts agree with this. One Chinese assessment concluded that the United States will remain a major power for an extended period of time, but that it now has a lessened ability to sustain a dominant hegemonic position in the world. I think that assessment is much more accurate than some of the pessimistic conclusions that you sometimes encounter in the media. The weaknesses that were seen in this Chinese analysis of the United States, because it saw all of our normal strengths in terms of favorable geographic position, rich natural resources, highly educated population, strong military, strong intelligence, only country with a truly durable outlook, etc., etc. But the weaknesses, dysfunctional political system, underperforming economy, global financial sectors, social division. True, this one was lessened ability by the United States to control the international institutions that emerged after World War II. The areas of strength are very difficult to create if you don't have them. The areas of weakness are all correctable if we get our act together in the United States. So that's important to remember. I see the United States as in temporary decline, and the question is whether leadership emerges in the United States sufficient to reverse that process. We don't know the answer to that yet. If the United States can sustain its position in East Asia, nevertheless, our budget deficits are signaling that at its current level of performance, the U.S. economy can no longer support the type of global role to which the United States became accustomed during the Cold War and during the first post-Cold War decade. If this judgment is accurate, then we're seeing an important distinction between the way China is responding to its new role in the world and the way the United States is responding. In China, Chinese are very conscious of the fact that they are becoming stronger and more prosperous, and that therefore their role in the world must change. So there's an active, serious debate in China taking place over whether China should stick to the advice of Deng Xiaoping, who said China should concentrate on economic development, it should keep a low profile, it should not seize a leadership position, but it shouldn't be passive. It should have some accomplishments. This was Deng's advice, and essentially it's been the focus of Chinese official policy, and still is. But it's under attack in China. Chinese are saying, we're a strong country. Why aren't we defending our territorial integrity more actively against these other countries who are trying to seize Chinese territory? They're saying the Deng idea is appropriate for the past, but now we have the second largest economy in the world. We may soon have the largest economy in the world. We should be more active. So this debate is a serious debate, and it's focused on the question of how China's resources should be linked to how it behaves in the world. In the United States, I would contend, the United States is averse to acknowledging that they have to play a diminished role in the world, one more suited to what we can afford. I agree the United States does not like the G2 concept any more than China does. We like a G1 concept. But that's a funny concept. The diffusion of power in the world is reflected in the nature of the new organizations that are becoming features of the international scene. This includes the BRICS, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, the ASEAN Plus 3. None of those organizations has the United States at the table. But it also includes the Group of 20, the East Asia Summit. These are organizations that didn't exist before the Asian financial crisis back in 1997. In other words, there's been a transformation in the world in terms of the organizations that are emerging, and this reflects the multipolarization of the world. So thinking of a sole superpower and a unipolar world, in my judgment, is simply not reflecting international reality. But in the United States, even those who see a new isolationism in our reluctance to intervene militarily in Syria view this as more an attitude of mind or war weariness from our involvement in Iraq and Afghanistan rather than a reflection of our reduced circumstances. In other words, we're still thinking as though we have enough capability, financial, economic capability, to play the old role, but in reality we don't. And we're not having the serious debate that China is having as to what the U.S. role should be in the context of these circumstances. So I see that as a problem that we have to deal with, and it's very relevant for the rise of China. But in the case of China, we also have to be careful about assuming that China is 10 feet tall and will be continuing its extraordinary rate of growth over the next 30 years or longer. Much will depend on the quality of China's leadership. And quite frankly, that is the reason why China has been able to sustain this rapid growth as rapidly as it has. It is destabilizingly rapid. I can remember a Chinese premier making a private comment to me where I asked him what was the biggest threat to China faced. He said it was too rapid growth. He defines too rapid growth as 8% growth. China has been growing at nearly 2 percentage points higher than that over most of the last 30 years. And the destabilizing factors that are emerging in China are serious. And so, the second aspect, some of you may have read an article by Martin Wolf in the Financial Times a couple of months ago. In it, he addressed the question of whether China's economy might suddenly topple. The problem is a double one. China is moving into what's called the middle income trap, and China is facing the problem of countries who begin to catch up with the most developed countries. Now, for those of you who are economists, the middle income trap occurs when a developing country that has been able to sustain rapid development because of low wage costs and low land costs, low factor costs, when those factors begin to rise, you lose your competitive advantage. 101 countries have fallen into the middle income trap since 1960. 9% have been successful in getting out of it. In other words, countries reach a certain level of development and then they run into this middle income trap, and unless they can develop new sources of productivity in their economy, they can't get out of the trap. So China's into the trap now, and whether its leaders can get out of the trap is a major question. The second problem is it's catching up with new advanced economies. If you look at South Korea and Japan, Japan did not make the transition to catching up with the advanced economies well. It's been stagnating for the last 20 years. So that is an additional problem that China may face, on top of the demographic and all the other considerations that have been outlined. Now, in fact, China's leaders focus on the problem. It's not like the U.S. government. I mean, it's unbelievable to watch us struggling with this issue of whether we'll pay our debts in October and whether we'll keep the government open next week. China's leaders focus on the issues they need to focus on. They can't solve the problem, so they can keep them manageable. And that's why China has been able to sustain development effectively for long. As long as they retain that quality of leadership, it seems to me we shouldn't be pessimistic about time. But several points to keep in mind in thinking about the relationship between the United States and China as China continues to grow stronger. First, China's military modernization program makes sense. I'm still irritated by the Secretary of Defense of the United States who said that China was spending too much in defense, it didn't have any threat. Why expose your ignorance about history so dramatically and publicly? For much of the last 200 years, China has been unable to defend its own territory. Over the last 30 years, China has accumulated more wealth than in the previous 150 years. This wealth is heavily concentrated in China's coastal areas, and it's a fundamental national interest in China to be able to move the location of possible conflicts away from China's borders. Second, China is not the Soviet Union. Its rise has benefited its neighbors. They do not want to hold down China's growth because it is helping their own economy. Their interest is in responsible Chinese behavior as a major emerging power, not in constraining China's growth. When China, in their eyes, behaves irresponsibly or seems to act coercively, they want the assurance provided by the reliable presence of a militarily strong country such as the United States that can offset China's growing power. But no regional power wants to choose between China and the United States. If the United States in regional eyes seems to be mishandling its relations with China, then they lose confidence in American policy, because they don't want the United States riling China and making it a more dangerous neighbor in the region. Now, this is a healthy dynamic, because it rewards responsible behavior, whether by China or the United States, and it imposes penalties for irresponsible behavior, as seen by China's neighbors. Each country, the United States and China probably think we always act responsibly. So you really need the objective view of the others as the test. The United States knows the difference between a hostile competitor and a non-hostile competitor. Bilateral trade between the United States and China, and trade is the most basic form of cooperation. You don't trade with anyone. Our trade with China is now running over $500 billion a year. The high point of U.S. trade with the Soviet Union during the Cold War was $4.5 billion in 1979. In other words, our trade with China is over 100 times greater than it ever was with the Soviet Union. Is this a containment policy? Pardon. In terms of U.S. investment flows into China, as opposed to the Soviet Union during the Cold War, the differential is even greater. Put these considerations together, and I think you can see that if the United States was seeking to contain China, it would lack the regional support necessary to accomplish this. Other countries don't want to go down China's growth. But this leaves open the question of whether the United States can get along with China. There are numerous indications that strategic rivalry between the United States and China has been increased, not diminishing. Top leaders in both China and the United States are concerned about this trend. They are conscious of the historical example, so I won't bore you with, about how the clash of interest between rising powers and established powers tends to lead to conflict. Since 1500, according to Graham Allison at Harvard, in the 16 cases where this occurred, in over two-thirds of them it resulted in conflict. So therefore the odds are against us if there's not policy intervention from the top in trying to reverse this development. Now, what is driving this strategic rivalry is not, in my opinion, differences of trade issues or human rights issues, etc., etc. If you recall that we were literally at war with Japan at the beginning of the 1980s when they were emerging as a serious economic competitor of the United States, but we were still strategic allies of Japan. So that doesn't drive the strategic suspicion between the United States and China. What's driving us is that both of us, both of our military establishments, are preparing for war with the other. In other words, we have a competition of military capabilities underway in the Western Pacific, and this is so many growing strategic rivalry between the United States and China, and this is dangerous. China is developing military capabilities that are threatening to the ability of the United States to operate in the Western Pacific. For example, they're developing a guidable missile, a ballistic missile, that would threaten our aircraft carriers. So the United States is responding with something called an air-sea battle concept, which would involve taking out the surveillance and missile capabilities and the missiles themselves that would be launched against our carriers. This involves attacks on the China mainland. Attacks on the Chinese mainland is a ticket to all-out war. Now, during the Soviet Union and the Cold War, we never ended up in direct conflict with the Soviet Union because we never could solve the problem that when another nuclear power has the capability to attack your own homeland, you can't afford to attack their homeland. And that problem is still unsolvable. So when we talk about war between China and the United States, frankly, it's not in the cards. An attack by China on an American aircraft carrier would result in counterattack on the Chinese mainland, and then you're facing the problem of nuclear escalation to a devastating proportion. That's a major constraint on starting down that road. So why should we be spending hundreds of billions of dollars developing military capabilities that we can't use? You can't go to the President and say, Mr. President, we've just lost an aircraft carrier, you've got to take out Kansas. Because he'll say, well, then they'll take out San Francisco. Not a good choice. So this poses the question. How do we bring the military activities of the two sides into conformity with a policy that has been set by top leaders in both countries of trying to create a new type of great power relationship between China and the United States that can bring this strategic rivalry under policy control? Not easy to do. To a significant degree, controlling escalation depends on the ability of each side accurately to read the bottom line of the other. We don't do well in this respect. If you recall, the Korean War began because Kim Il-sung, Stalin, and Mao Zedong misread the U.S. bottom line on Korea. And the Chinese came into the conflict because General MacArthur misread the Chinese bottom line when he supported having the U.N. forces cross the 38th parallel. If you can't use these things, even when the signals are very clear, not so clear in the case of the U.S. position, because we have made some statements that made it questionable whether Korea was within our defense perimeter. But we were a strong power, and the aggression in Korea amounted to an effort militarily to expand the communist world. And the United States responded, in my judgment, as you would expect a strong power to respond under those circumstances. But it was a massive misjudgment, and we can't afford that type of misjudgment again in the future. A further question that military leaders on each side need to address. Is it possible to establish a stable, conventional military balance throughout the Western Pacific that meets the fundamental security interests of each side? A major driving factor of this strategic misfire. Each of us wants a military balance in the Western Pacific that favors our side. Well, that's the natural human reaction. And that's why rising powers and established powers get in conflict. They're behaving normally. So we can't behave normally in trying to create this new type of great power relationship. We've got to recognize the policy context that has to guide our actions. So, what would the balance have to do? It would have to improve China's ability to defend its own territory, and it would have to enable the United States to have a sufficient military presence in the Western Pacific to maintain the credibility of our allies. That's Japan and South Korea. In each case, that's a fundamental national interest. And we have to see whether those two can be made compatible in some fashion, and we are just at the very beginning of trying to understand and think through that process. Now, historical experience suggests that the collapse of either side, barring the collapse of either side, there is no way to strike that balance looking at this as strictly a military problem. In other words, this is not a defense issue. This is a problem of grand strategy. We have an unfortified border with Canada. Why? Because our political relationship between the two countries suggests that we're not going to get into armed conflict with each other. And basically, people aren't worried about war in Europe at the moment, even though Russia and Europe have many differences, and Russia is a big, strong nuclear power. They're managing the political relationship all right. Tensions in the Taiwan Strait are low at the moment. Why? Because they've been able to find a way of dealing with each other, which has reduced the tensions in the past. So when I talk about a problem of land strategy, when we in China try to limit our strategic rivalry, it has to be viewed as requiring diplomacy, trade, people-to-people contact, addressing human rights issues, and bringing the military competition under control so that it doesn't drive an increasing growth in strategic rivalry. This is a principal strategic challenge facing both China and the United States. It is, in my judgment, resolvable by wise leadership, but we can't count on wise leadership, and that's why having this type of a conference and this type of a discussion, it seems to me, serves a useful purpose. Thank you.